with a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
With new McValue at McDonald's, you get more than you expect. So after a long day, buy a double cheeseburger and add a McChicken for a dollar. Because saving with deals is always on the menu with new McValue.
Prices and participation may vary. Valid for item of equal or lesser value.
Hey, small town fam, it's Yardley. I want to remind you that if you want access to bonus episodes and regular episodes a day early and ad-free, and our community forum and other behind-the-scenes goodies, you got to go to smalltowndicks.com/superfam, and then in the top right-hand corner, hit that little tab that says Join. And then listen to the end of today's episode for a sneak peek at today's new bonus episode. Hey, small town fam. It's Yardley. How are you guys? Oh, welcome to season 16. Hooray! We're so happy you're here. And it's your lucky day, my friends, because we have our own Paul Holes on the microphone today. I don't know if anyone's better than Paul at combining suspense and science whenever he talks about an investigation, and this case is no exception. The case Paul talks about today really got under his skin, and if you know the kinds of cases Paul has worked on over the years, you know that's saying a lot. At a couple of points in the story, you'll hear dead silence as Paul stops and gathers himself before he can go on. As always, Paul brings fresh eyes and fresh ideas to the table as law enforcement reopens the 1974 murder of Carla Walker. Paul's enthusiasm inspires the investigative team to pull out all the stops to get answers. And that out-of-the-box approach is instrumental in finally clearing the name of a man who'd been under suspicion for decades, while also giving some long overdue answers to Carla's family. But let's start at the beginning. Here is part one of Justice for Carla. Hi there, I'm Yardley.
I'm Dan.
I'm Dave.
And I'm Paul.
And this is Small Town Dicks.
Dave and I are identical twins
and retired detectives from small town USA.
And I'm a veteran cold case investigator who helped catch the Golden State Killer using a revolutionary DNA tool.
Between the three of us, we've investigated thousands of crimes, from petty theft to sexual assault, child abuse to murder.
Each case we cover is told by the detective who investigated it, offering a rare personal account of how they solved the crime.
Names, places, and certain details have been changed to protect the privacy of victims and their families.
And although we're aware that some of our listeners may be familiar with these cases, we ask you to please join us in continuing to protect the true identities of those involved
out of respect for what they've been through.
Thank you.
Today on Small Town Dicks, we have the usual suspects. We have Detective Dan.
Greetings.
Greetings. Greetings, you. We have Detective Dave.
Hello, all.
Hello. Hello, sir. And we have the one and only Paul Holes.
Hey, hey, hi.
Hey, hi. I love it. I love it so much. And small town fam, I feel like if we could, we would throw a parade for today, because today on the microphones, we don't actually have an awesome guest. We have the awesome A-team. And it's funny, you know, when I ask Dan, Dave, and Paul, do you have any more cases that you could do for an episode? They're all like, no, I'm all tapped out. I've wrung out my library. And I'm like, I just don't think that's true. I respect it, but we'll also twist their arms as much as possible. And today, it actually worked. And so Paul Holes is going to give us a case. So, Paul, you're such an old pro. I'm just going to hand it over to you.
I thought you were going to ask me, how did this case come to you?
Well, I am then. I am going to ask you, tell us, Paul, how did this case come to you?
This case came to me twice, both
under unusual circumstances. The first time I had this case put in front of me was at a crime con.
Oh.
So this was obviously after I retired, and I think it was the New Orleans crime con. And I'm very busy at crime cons, you know, with the various events, and I meet a lot of people. So I just have a vague memory, long line of people during the meet and greet, and a woman came up and handed me a piece of paper with a photo of a young woman on it. And this was a summary of this Carla Walker case. And this is not abnormal. I get handed documents from a variety of people asking me to take a look at their loved one's case.
I'm guessing it's a little bit like being a doctor at a dinner party and they're like, listen, I have this thing on my blah, blah, and can you check it out right now? And they just expect you to hand you a little bit of info and go, you could solve this, right? I'll be back at 5.
Right. Well, and obviously at Crime Con, I can't be reviewing whatever's handed to me. So typically I bring these documents home. And then once I kind of get settled, then I do actually kind of look at them. And quite frankly, I don't remember what I did with that document. I don't remember reaching out. You know, most people, when they reach out and they're asking me to help out in their case, well, it also requires cooperation from the investigating agency. Without that, there's really nothing I can help. So, you know, this just kind of probably faded in my memory. I just hardly remember this incident. And then I had a TV show, DNA of Murder. The way that the TV show worked was that supervising producers would come up with cases, summarize those cases, and then have me review to see if it's a case I had interest in and thought I could impact. I reviewed so many cases, but one of the cases was this homicide out of Fort Worth PD of a 17-year-old girl, Carla Walker. And, you know, again, the bells are kind of dinging. I've seen this case before somewhere, you know?
And Paul, can I just ask you, was the woman who handed you a sort of a one sheet on the case at Crime Con, was she related to the case in any way, or was she an armchair sleuth? What was her particular interest in it?
I ended up seeing her again, and this was at somewhat of a memorial for Carla Walker. And she came up to me and said she was the one that had handed me material on the Carla Walker case in the beginning, thinking that that's what spurred me getting involved with the case. And so she, if I recall correctly, was a close family friend and obviously very passionate about this case. So for the show, I ended up reviewing the case saying, yeah, you know, this is something that I want to help out on.
This is for DNA of Murder you're talking about.
This is for the DNA of Murder. And this show was where I was legitimately working with agencies, consulting with the investigators, talking to family, friends, even suspects in some instances, trying to solve these cases. So I had access to material in order to actually be effective. And in this particular case, after I said yes, and Oxygen Network agreed that it was a case that they were going to have for one of the episodes, eventually I got involved. And the initial involvement was a discussion with the current cold case investigator at Fort Worth, Jeff Bennett. And that discussion, I was actually up in Vancouver doing a presentation on the Golden State Killer case. And I was at Butch Art Gardens with a couple of my GSK buds from back in the day, as well as a Vancouver PD detective who was actually the organizer of this. And Jeff Bennett from Fort Worth PD calls me. And he's very, very passionate about the Carla Walker case. But his big position in terms of cooperating with the show was to get the show to help pay for the forensic testing.
Because you had some DNA evidence?
They had some DNA evidence that they had looked at over the decades, but nothing that was real promising in terms of when I was taking a look at the forensic lab reports. And we had built into our budget for the DNA of Murder show to pay for some forensic testing. But what Jeff was asking for was far above what our typical budget was. And he was like, I need more, you know, and he eventually got more, which turned out to be very, very good in this case. But ultimately, this is how I'm getting involved in the Carla Walker case. And that's when I go out to Fort Worth PD and meet with Jeff Bennett and his partner, Leah Wagner, the two assigned at that time to their cold case unit. And I will tell you, this case is somewhat of a trigger for me. It turns into one of my tougher cases, you know, from an emotional standpoint. And I think you'll find out why. But this case involves 17-year-old Carla Walker. And this is February of 1974. She had gone to a Valentine's dance at her high school with her boyfriend. He was the star quarterback of the football team.
What was his name?
Rodney. You know, they go to the dance. It's February 17th, so a little after the actual formal Valentine's. And they end up leaving the dance and start driving around. And Rodney and Carla pick up another couple. And as teenagers are prone to do, you know, they've got alcohol. They're drinking. There may even have been some marijuana use as they're driving around. And eventually, after stopping at the Taco Bell in town, which was the kids' hangout, they go to the bowling alley, Wrigley Bowling Alley. And the reason they go to the bowling alley is the Taco Bell restrooms were shut down. And I forget the reason why. So they had to go to the bowling alley and Carla had to go use the restroom. So Rodney and Carla go inside the bowling alley. They come out, they get into Rodney's car. And Rodney's driving, it's one of those huge Pontiac cars with the big front bench seats. And Rodney, of course, is the driver and Carla is on the front passenger side. This is roughly about 12:15 when they get back into their vehicle. Rodney and Carla are back in their vehicle and they are talking. The front passenger door whips open and a man with a pistol sticks his head in, grabs Carla. And Rodney's initial statements, the man told him, "I'm going to kill you," and then shoots Rodney. So Rodney said the man shot him. Rodney slumped down to the seat. And Carla is drug out. Rodney just remembers Carla yelling, "Go get my dad," as she's being drug off to a car that Rodney said had five or six other men in it.
Hey, small town fam, it's Yardley. How are you guys? It's spring here on the West Coast, and I am so excited to have a bright, bold manicure to add a little pep to my step. But honestly, getting to the nail salon, I don't have a lot of time for that. So that's why I love my Olive & June. Their mani system has everything I need for a salon-quality manicure at home. So, for instance, they have salon-grade tools. You get your choice of six gorgeous polishes, all with a formula that lasts up to 7 days without chipping. Yes, please. And the best part, it breaks down to just $2 per manicure. Come on, that is a deal you can't pass up. So I just tried their new spring collection. I absolutely love the colors. My favorite, Rodeo Queen. You have to try Rodeo Queen. It's the perfect pinky red with a dash of silver shimmer right up my alley. And if you love a gel-like finish, their polish gives that beautiful glossy look and you don't even need a UV lamp. Plus, no more scheduling appointments or sitting in a salon chair for hours. Now I can do my nails whenever I want. So whether or not it's midnight and I decide I need a manicure right this second or it's a quick polish change just before going out, it's up to me. So, Small Town Fam, right now, Olive and June is offering 20% off your first system. All you have to do is visit oliveandjune.com/smalltown. That's oliveandjune.com/smalltown for 20% off your first system. Do it. So, Paul, if Rodney was shot, does he actually get to Carla's parents' house?
Yes. So what ends up happening is Rodney, once he recovers from the shooting, drives to Carla's parents' house. And Carla is living with her parents. She's 17 years old. And he is seen initially by the family, including Carla's younger brother, who was 12 at the time, Jim. And Rodney is bleeding extensively from his head. His shirt, which was a button-up shirt, was unbuttoned, and he has a lot of blood on his shirt as well as on his upper torso. Where the Walker family lived was outside of Fort Worth city limits. It was in Benbrook. So initially, you have Benbrook officers arriving at the family residence and interviewing Rodney and trying to get a description of this man. And Rodney initially states that this man had a cowboy hat on, military, like crew cut type of hairstyle. And I never heard this term, but said he was a goat roper.
A goat roper? I've never heard that. You're nodding, Dave. Do you know what that is?
I can surmise based on some other terms that I've heard over the years, but basically it's somebody who's familiar with the country is how I take that.
Yeah, and I guess it's somewhat of a derogatory term.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Like a redneck.
Yeah, if you're a cowboy, you know, that's cool. But if you're a goat roper, nope.
You don't sit with the cool kids.
Right. Big hat, no cattle.
That's just it. So Carla is nowhere to be found, and her dad goes to the bowling alley parking lot, and Carla's purse is on the ground, presumably got drug out when she was drug out of the car. And then right near that purse is a magazine from a pistol for a Ruger 22, and it is fully loaded with 22 caliber ammunition.
That seems unusual that you would leave a fully loaded magazine behind. No, Dan and Dave are shaking their heads. No, not unusual.
Well, when Rodney goes to the hospital for his injuries, he's got lacerations basically to the top of his head, as well as a cut to just underneath his right eye on his cheek. And he wasn't shot. He had been pistol whipped.
Oh.
And this is where the offender, you know, during the pistol whipping, likely hit the magazine release and was completely unaware that he dropped his magazine onto the parking lot.
Ah, I see.
Great little piece of physical evidence there.
Yeah.
So now there's some concern. You know, Rodney initially claimed that he had been shot. He obviously was confused, or changing his story that he wasn't shot, he had been pistol whipped. And so this is now within a week of Carla going missing, Rodney is starting to change his story. The other issue is Rodney claims to have lost consciousness. And then when he came to, he drove straight to the Walker residence. However, Carla was abducted around 12:20 a.m. Rodney doesn't show up at the Walker residence until 1:50 a.m., an hour and a half later. So this is an issue. This is a gap in his timeline. The inside of Rodney's car, in the front seat, there's a lot of blood staining, blood drops, blood smears. And as you know, if you've ever injured your scalp to where you split the skin, it bleeds extensively. And so Rodney's claim of losing consciousness and laying for a period of time on the front seat, I would expect to see a pooled source of blood where he had been laying, and that wasn't present inside his vehicle.
So what did you see?
As Rodney is moving around in the front of the car, there's, you know, drips coming off of his head. He's smearing the blood as he's interacting inside, as he's driving to the Walker residence. When I'm starting to assess the crime scene and trying to look at Rodney's statements, I'm having some concerns. And this is, you know, we're early on. It's like, well, what did Rodney do for that hour and a half? You know, the whole set of circumstances are suspicious, straight up, right? You mean your girlfriend got abducted right under your nose and you're, you know, the star football player and, you know.
And the other question also is, why did you go to Carla's parents' house and not call the police from, you would assume there's a payphone at the bowling alley.
Absolutely.
So there are a lot of red flags here.
And I had those red flags from the very beginning about Rodney and the circumstances. And then over the decades, Rodney has been interviewed multiple times, both by law enforcement as well as media, who had put some attention on the case. And every time he had been interviewed about what happened, he changed his story. So as I'm initially assessing the case, of course, I'm going, okay, I'm going to have to really pay attention to Rodney as I, you know, do my investigation. So Carla was last seen being abducted by this goat roper, being pulled towards a vehicle. And there's a big search out for this abducted 17-year-old girl. And 3 days later, her body is found. So south of Fort Worth, south of where the bowling alley was located at, there's a big lake. I think it's called Benbrook Lake. And there's several roads off the main freeway that will go out towards the direction of that lake. And it's a lot of, you know, like cattle type of land. And where her body was found is in what's called a cow culvert. So Carla's body is found in this cow culvert. And I didn't even know what a cow culvert was. But it is a cement tunnel that goes underneath the road that the cows can be moved by the ranchers from one part of their property to another without having to cross the road. So this cement tunnel, which in this case is rectangular shaped, it's not round shaped. And the openings on each end have cement that slope down to the ground. And then there's barbed wire fencing around both ends of this culvert. So the cows don't have free access. The ranchers have to open up the gate on one side and on the other one in order to be able to get the cows through. But Carla's body is found inside this culvert. So the offender had to get her body somehow past the barbed wire and then placed in the middle of the culvert. Now, this culvert, I don't have exact measurements, but I would say this culvert is about 50 feet long and maybe 4 feet wide and almost 6 feet high. It's very cramped, very, very dark inside this tunnel. So Carla's body, she's laying face up. She had this blue dress that her sister had actually worn, I think, to the prom the year before. So it was a hand-me-down dress, and the dress has been torn off of Carla, exposing her lower body. Yet the upper part of the dress, you know, her bra had been pushed up above her breast, but the upper part of the dress had been placed by the offender covering her breast. Carla had been strangled. She had lots of abrasions, significant abrasions, like to her jaw, her hip area, shoulder area, as well as her knees. And these, you know, you can't say if they were before she died. They look to me like they're transport injuries, which I commonly see on victims' bodies being moved in and out of vehicles like a truck bed. And here, you know, she has to be moved through the barbed wire or dropped into the kind of the cement opening, and most certainly some of these abrasions could have been done during the disposal, body disposal process. When I got this case, what struck me, Carla, you know, 17 years old, but looking at her laying here in this cow culvert, you know, the crime scene photos, she looks like she's 12. She's a petite 17-year-old girl. You know, she's 4'11", 100 pounds. You know, while she's laying here, still has the blue barrettes in her hair, you know, kind of keeping them back. She had the blue eyeliner matching the color of the dress. You know, and kind of where I go is, you know, she went out to a Valentine's dance with her boyfriend. And in a matter of minutes, her life is over, in essence. She's sexually assaulted, strangled, and then disposed of. So all the hopes and dreams that she had, you know, gone. And of course, her loved ones, they no longer have Carla.
You probably know PXG for their incredible golf clubs. Did you know they bring that same precision and passion to their apparel too? I got a few pieces from their spring-summer 2025 collection, and I have to say, I'm seriously impressed. I've played PXG clubs for years, but only recently started wearing their apparel. The quality is next level. The fabrics feel premium. The fit is spot on. The style has that classic preppy look, but updated in a way that works anywhere, not just on the course. I wore mine straight from the golf course to dinner with Dan at our favorite steakhouse, and even got a heartfelt compliment from the guy. A rare occurrence in this decades-long sibling rivalry. PXG nailed it with this collection. Great prints, clean silhouettes, and everything is designed to move with you. It's stylish, comfortable, and built to perform. Detective Dan approved. Elevate your style game on and off the course with PXG Apparel's Spring-Summer 2025 collection. Head over to pxgapparel.com/smalltown to save 10% on your order. That's pxgapparel.com/smalltown to save 10%. pxgapparel.com/smalltown.
The autopsy showed that significant number of sperm were found from Carla Walker's vaginal swab. And so, of course, when I'm reviewing that with modern DNA technology, it's like, well, why isn't this case solved? You know, what's going on? And the forensic testing that had been done by multiple labs over the decades was focusing in on either hair, or they're going after YSTR profiles from a stain off of the blue dress. It's like, well, what's going on? Why isn't the vaginal swab being examined? And why aren't we getting a CODIS-eligible profile? So that was part of the questions that I had going into this case.
And Paul, is the YSTR information you're trying to get, is that the newest technology or that's the older technology for DNA testing?
So the STR technology, short tandem repeat, is the technology that crime labs started to use generally around the late 1990s. And this is the technology that the FBI's DNA database called CODIS is built off of. An STR profile is literally just a series of numbers, and those numbers represent sort of the genetic information that generates the profile that DNA analysts can use to compare, let's say, a suspect's DNA sample to evidence found at the crime scene. YSTRs is, in essence, the same technology, but it's focusing in on the male chromosome, the Y chromosome. And generally, labs resort to YSTR testing when there's very little male DNA present and there's a whole bunch of, let's say, Carla's DNA present. And so typically, let's say off of a vaginal swab, Carla's DNA is going to be there. Tons of cells out of her vaginal cavity will be on that swab. And then let's say there's just a few sperm. You try to separate that sperm out, but sometimes you can't. And now you have a big mixture in which the female's contribution overwhelms the little bit of male DNA there. So you don't even see the DNA profile using traditional STR testing. Companies developed this YSTR technology, so now you ignore all the female's DNA and can just focus in on that little bit of male DNA in there to be able to get a YSTR profile.
That's pretty incredible.
It's amazing technology, but that's where my question was at, is the pathologist is saying numerous spermatozoa, numerous sperm on the microscope slide that he made and is looking through the microscope during autopsy and going, yeah, there's a lot of sperm here. Why are they resorting to that? You know, I'm not understanding this. So I get out to Fort Worth and now I'm talking to the investigators, talking to an original investigator from back in the day who was at the autopsy. And he said, not only was there a ton of semen, the pathologist noted that he could visually see pooled semen vaginally and had used a syringe and sucked up about 5 cc's of fluid.
Holy shit.
So where is that? And turns out it's gone.
No.
I've run into this over and over from this era. That pathologist probably threw out that microscope slide, as well as probably the vaginal swab, because he, in 1974, couldn't do anything with it out saying, yes, there's sperm present, she was raped. And it's so frustrating when that happens. But where's the syringe, you know, with all this fluid that likely contains, you know, the killer's semen? And that also has been lost over time, you know. And so this is part of the process of working these older unsolved cases is I can't go back and resurrect this lost evidence. It's gone. I have to work with what we have.
Wow. We've heard so many stories about this now, and it is incredibly frustrating. And so when you find investigators, and we even talked about it in the limited series we did called Ruxin, where they somehow had the foresight to preserve things in a way that had never been done before with a sort of a prescient thought that, I don't know, maybe it'll be useful. I'm not sure how. And so when you're talking about 1974, any investigators who were like, listen, I can't do anything with it now, but let me not be the last word.
Yes. So after I reviewed the forensic testing that had been done and the fact that what I was hoping to have present, you know, the vaginal swab, that was gone. You know, my recommendation to Fort Worth PD, and they were already thinking along these lines, Jeff and Lee were already thinking along these lines, is we need to do comprehensive screening for additional DNA off of all the clothing on Carla. That blue dress, her bra, her panties and pantyhose had been found kind of tossed out near the opening of the culvert.
Sorry, does the comprehensive testing mean now you're going to try to discover other evidence of DNA on the clothing using more modern methods?
Absolutely. And this is something that I have learned on cases that I've personally worked, both in the lab as well as cold cases, is that I do not rely upon what was done 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, even recently. I want everything revisited because I have seen labs miss, analysts miss evidence. And some of it has to do just with, you know, the change in technology over time. Some of it has to do with laziness. Some of it has to do with, it can be really, really hard to find DNA evidence, you know, especially on a larger item like the dress, or imagine a king size comforter and you're looking for a little drip on there, you know. And so Fort Worth PD sent Carla's clothing as well as some other items to Serological Research Institute out in the Bay Area. This is a private lab that I have great familiarity with, and they deploy a broader set of screening methodologies than many of the law enforcement-based laboratories. And it's just unfortunate, you know, across the nation that forensic labs have dropped some of the screening methodologies to help find potential DNA evidence. Most notably, I rarely see law enforcement-based labs today utilizing what's called an acid phosphatase mapping technique. Acid phosphatase is an enzyme that is found in higher concentrations in semen and can be used to try to locate semen stains. And it's a mapping technique where if I'm, let's say, have a bed sheet, in essence, I grid that bed sheet and then I have big square pieces of filter paper that get moistened and then pressed down for a period of time on each of these grids. And then I can take that filter paper, hang it up in a fume hood, and spray it with a chemical. And this chemical turns a color wherever there's this acid phosphatase. So now if I get a brownish-purple reaction on this filter paper, I can go back to that location on the bed sheet and go, right here, I've got potentially semen stain. Labs aren't doing this technique anymore. And they say, well, we screen it with an alternate light source, which you talked about, your blue light. But today, there's many different wavelengths that can be used. I've personally seen alternate light sources miss semen stains, and I found them utilizing this acid phosphatase mapping technique. You know, so when I consult on a case, I don't want to read a lab report and they say no semen found. I want to know, well, how did you look for it? And part of the issue that I'm running into is labs don't like to share their notes anymore.
Oh, boy. Dave and I have experience in that.
And why is that? Are we all going for the same goal?
I will say, in addition to what Paul was saying about, you know, laziness, there's all sorts of factors. I admit, labs are completely overwhelmed with case submissions. I mean, it's every day. I can't imagine being in a lab because it's from everywhere. You're getting hit from all sides. I would submit a rape kit for analysis at the lab, and I know that that's going to take months. After about 4 or 5 months, you get an email from the analyst in the lab who says, hey, can you send me the reports? I need to know why you want this checked for this. And I'm like, no, that's not how I want this to work. I want you to tell me if there's evidence present. I want you to go about it like Paul does.
You don't want confirmation bias playing into this analysis.
Exactly. And this was an ongoing issue that I had, especially in sexual assault cases, where I was fighting with labs about why I put on my lab request, I want you to test this for this. And I'm not trying to hammer our lab folks. I'm just saying from a law enforcement perspective, that can be really frustrating.
Just like in any occupation, you have a spectrum of competence, a spectrum of effort. And then there's also just sometimes, as Dave mentioned, the volume of casework. The analysts are essentially, I've got this evidence, I'm doing my approved procedures, I either find DNA containing evidence or no DNA, move on to the next case. And what often happens is with this one pass mindset, they get a sample that gives them, let's say, a partial DNA profile. Well, they report out that partial DNA profile, but don't go back to the original item of evidence and say, well, maybe if I take a cutting or a swabbing just to the left or right of where I initially sampled, there might be more of that DNA there in higher concentrations and I get a full profile. But this is one of the reasons in Carla Walker's case, after assessing what had been done, let's redo everything.
Hey, small town fam, it's Yardley. How are you? Are you hungry? Let's talk about bread. Let's talk about hero bread. Because you know when you find something that just makes life easier but also tastier, how great that is? Well, that's how I feel about hero bread. I do love bread. Bread and I go way back. And hero bread lets me enjoy all my favorites while I'm also getting extra fiber and protein. Both of those things are things I want in my bread. Hero Bread, also tortillas, bagels, rolls, all have ultra low net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and they're high in fiber. Yes, please. But here's the best part. Oh my God, they taste so good. They're soft and fluffy and just as satisfying as that other bread that you might buy that's not as good as Hero Bread. So the other night I made some enchiladas using their tortillas and they were superb. The tortillas held up so beautifully. They didn't tear. There was no weird texture, they weren't stiff, they were just soft and delicious. And knowing they have just 1 gram of net carbs per serving, that just made me feel even a little bit better about making those tortillas a regular part of my meals. So, Small Town Fam, if you want bread that fits into your lifestyle without sacrificing flavor or texture, because why should you, Hero Bread has you covered. And right now, they're offering 10% off your order. All you have to do is head to hero.co and use the code SMALLTOWN, which is all one word, at checkout. That's hero.co, code SMALLTOWN for 10% off. Yes, do it.
Imagine for a minute, imagine the best version of you, where you look and feel your best self, where your confidence shines through every day. This is how your skincare routine should make you feel, an easy-to-use system giving your skin exactly what it needs so you look and feel your best. Well, imagine no more, because Meaningful Beauty has arrived. Businesswoman, entrepreneur, and supermodel Cindy Crawford founded Meaningful Beauty with world-renowned cosmetic specialist Dr. Sabah to share his age-maintenance-focused skincare treatments and formulas. Cindy has been consistently using this breakthrough age-maintenance system to protect her skin and prevent premature signs of aging for over 20 years. If there's proof of the power of consistent age maintenance, you only have to look at Cindy. She's not gorgeous for her age, she's just gorgeous. Inside and out, she's a shining example of a never-too-early, never-too-late-to-start an age-maintenance practice that meaningfully embraces your age. Nature provides ways to protect us from the environment, and Meaningful Beauty's secret is a unique and powerful antioxidant derived from a genetically rare melon found only in the south of France, a region known for women having beautiful skin. I love the 7-piece deluxe face and neck skincare system featuring effective serums, treatments, and creams formulated to work together to provide exactly what you need to achieve a more radiant, youthful appearance. Personally, I've been really loving the Youth Activating Melon Serum. It smells so delicious, feels incredible, and my skin looks amazing. And I've been getting so many compliments on how my skin has been looking recently. Over 5 million women have used Meaningful Beauty for its innovative formulas that help achieve radiant, younger-looking skin and hair so you can look and feel your best at every age. That gives you confidence to go out and live your life fully, whatever that means to you. Amazingly, after using Meaningful Beauty for 8 weeks, 100% of women said their skin looks vibrant and bright. It's never too late and it's never too early to start taking care of your skin. Try the Meaningful Beauty 7-piece deluxe face and neck skincare system for 60 days. If you're not completely satisfied, just return the bottles, even if empty, and get your money back. And remember, your confidence is beautiful too. Tomorrow's gorgeous starts today. Go to meaningfulbeauty.com/glow to receive 25% off and get the targeted treatment duo gift set for free. Go to meaningfulbeauty.com/glow to receive 25% off and get the targeted treatment duo gift set for free. meaningfulbeauty.com/glow.
Ready to plug into the future of podcasting? The Podcast Show is back. The biggest international festival for the business of podcasting hits London on the 21st and 22nd of May. Join over 10,000 creators, brands, and audio pros for 2 packed days at the Business Design Center in Islington. We're talking over 130 game-changing sessions with industry heavyweights, award-winning talent, and exclusive parties and networking events that go way beyond the show. And that's not all. The Podcast Show Live brings your favorite podcasts to life at venues across London all week long. Day passes start from just £109. Book now at thepodcastshowlondon.com.
So all of this evidence, Carla Walker's clothing items, get sent to SERI, Serological Research Institute, out in the Bay Area. And I requested, I want comprehensive testing done. So that happens. Now I'm out in Fort Worth and I am doing my investigation. Of course, I want to talk to Rodney.
Rodney, the boyfriend. Back to the boyfriend.
You know, now we are talking, I mean, this is a 1974 case, and I'm looking at this case in 2019.
I'm not sure Rodney really wants to talk to you about this or about it ever again.
Rodney most certainly has been under suspicion for a half century. And here I am coming in, kind of suspicious of Rodney too, right? <Yeah. laughs> And so it's like, well, yeah, I want to interview him. And so arrange a sit-down interview. And this is, you know, in front of cameras.
In front of television cameras or police interrogation cameras?
This is in front of television cameras. So this is being filmed for the show. And I ask Rodney to detail what happened that night that Carla went missing. And once again, some of the details of his original statements changed. And so I was going, okay, you know, half century has gone by. So you could see where memories fade. And I saw that some of Rodney's memories of what happened that night had faded. And I thought, well, I want to do more of a cognitive type of interview and put Rodney inside his vehicle. Having a production company backing something like this type of investigation, they go out and they find that same make model car of that vintage.
Really?
And so we end up taking it out to the bowling alley parking lot and place it approximately where Rodney remembered he had parked that night for Carla to go in and use the restroom. And so now it's like, okay, Rodney, you're inside this vehicle. He's surrounded by the environment of what happened back in February of 1974. And I had a co-host with me, Lonnie Coombs. Lonnie is a former Los Angeles DA who has been on numerous true crime shows, and I used her for multiple cases for DNA of Murder. And Lonnie and I just clicked. We not only got along very well, she complimented my skill set. I'm a big picture guy, right? Lonnie is so detail-oriented, and she's so good at doing interviews. So we would be sitting down and interviewing family, friends, etc. And Lonnie will be taking notes, and then she'll slide it over to me and tap on the notepad and say, make sure you ask this question.
That's the kind of collaboration you want in an investigation of any size.
Absolutely. And two different skill sets. Lonnie has that legal mind. And of course, I have the forensic background, the investigative background. And so when Lonnie and I were talking about Rodney, and I was bringing up, I am very suspicious about Rodney's claim of he was unconscious and laid inside this vehicle for a period of time. I don't see a blood pool. And then how come I've got blood drops all the way over on Carla's side of the front seat and down where the seatbelt mechanism would be? It's like he's over on that side bleeding.
Well, let me ask you this. What if as he passes out, he falls over and his head is now where Carla was sitting?
That's where being inside this replica vehicle really showed physically that would not happen. And so now my theory was, well, Rodney has an hour and a half after Carla was supposedly abducted before he shows up at Carla's parents' house. Well, that's enough time to get down to the Cal culvert, put Carla's body in that culvert through the barbed wire and across the cement, and then drive back. And so I'm thinking, well, Rodney is pulling Carla's body out of the front of the vehicle, and that's why he's on that side of the vehicle and dripping blood down, right? And this scratch underneath Rodney's eye, I was going, how does that happen during a pistol whipping? That's more like he got hit with a barb from the barbed wire, like he's trying to get through the barbed wire. And I went and interviewed a Dallas pathologist who looked at that and said, yeah, that's more consistent with, you know, a pointed object scraping along his cheek. So I've got some concerns. And so now I'm thinking Rodney actually is the one that he sexually assaulted and strangled and dumped Carla's body. So getting back to now doing more of this cognitive interview of Rodney, reenact what happened. And Rodney walks Lonnie and I through what happened.
Well, I'm curious, when Rodney agrees to come on the DNA of Murder and sit down with you and have an interview and also do this reenactment in the car that they procure to, you know, set the scene, what's his affect or what's his intention? I'm here to once again clear my name. I'm here to prove something. I'm just sort of curious if he was at all defensive or just kind of, I'm going to tell you everything I know.
So when I was interviewing Rodney, both for the sit-down interview as well as inside the simulated car, he was cooperative. I didn't get any sense of nervousness on his part, did not seem evasive in answering any of the questions that I asked of him. So he's checking the boxes that he's just trying to cooperate and provide the best information he can. It's just my perspective is, well, I know what his prior statements are. Now he's telling me something that there's details that are different. So it just, that's really where I was putting some weight on, is at a certain point, I would think that he would have locked his statement in and it just continued to evolve. Lonnie had told me ahead of time, I'm not getting any bad vibes about Rodney. I don't think he's involved in Carla's death. I think he's telling the truth. And then as Rodney is reenacting what he did, one of the things that he started showing us, Lonnie and I, is that when he was driving, the front passenger door hadn't been shut. And so when he took a turn, it kind of swung out wide. So he reached over while he was driving in order to pull the car door shut. And when he reenacted that, that would put his head over the location where I had concerns about the blood drips and the smear. And Lonnie looked at me and was like, see, I told you. And here I am, the blood pattern expert, right?
But it makes sense. So you're saying, Paul, that after Carla's abducted, the door is not shut completely. So when Rodney does finally drive away and he makes this turn, the door swings open and that's why his blood is over there.
That's it.
But how, I mean, even the best blood spatter analyst wouldn't necessarily infer that scenario. That's pretty awesome.
Actually, I thought about it the whole time and I've got quite a history of blood analysis.
And part of interpreting blood patterns, it's more of, okay, I can tell what type of pattern I have. I have a drip. I have a smear. So if I have a drip that's, let's say, completely perpendicular, it fell straight down. Oh, I have a bleeding source above that location. I can't say, well, this is what that person was doing in terms of formal blood pattern interpretation. But investigatively, I'm going, well, this adds up with Rodney being over on that side of the vehicle, pulling Carla's body out to dispose of it. Turns out I was wrong about that. I can't draw that conclusion. But then I also have this scratch. And we have this magazine from a .22 caliber Ruger. So I reached out to a former firearms examiner that I worked with, that I actually had hired for the lab that I worked for. His name was Chris Coleman. And so he brought that type of Ruger. And he also brought some pigskin. And Chris knows his guns, right? And he said this particular model of Ruger has a very sharp front sight. So by using pigskin over, like, I think it was a volleyball or something, he was showing how during a pistol whipping, if the front sight had hit this part of Rodney's face, it could cause that type of injury.
No kidding.
Okay, so now I can't say that Rodney got that injury from the barbed wire out there at the Cal Culvert.
Wow, wow, wow. So here you are, Paul, 50 years later, finally lifting the cloud of suspicion on Rodney because it seems like he really didn't do it.
Yeah.
That is incredible. Let's put a pin in this right here and come back next week to answer the question, who killed Carla Walker? Now for a sneak peek at today's new bonus episode.
Back in the fall, there was an officer with a department who does a person stop out on the street, suspicious person, ends up arresting this person for drug possession, fentanyl and meth, and gets back to the department, lodges the evidence, but keeps some for himself.
Oh, no.
And goes into the bathroom and smokes a little meth in the bathroom, and there's fentanyl in the meth, and he ODs.
To listen to today's bonus episode and access hundreds more, go to smalltowndicks.com/superfam and hit that little join button. Small Town Dicks was created by Detectives Dan and Dave. The podcast is produced by Jessica Halstead and me, Yardley Smith. Our senior editor is Soren Bajan, and our editors are Christina Bracamontes and Aaron Phelps. Our associate producers are The Real Nick Smitty and Aaron Gaynor. Gary Scott is our executive producer, and Logan Heftel is our production manager. Our books are cooked and cats wrangled by Ben Cornwell. And our social media maven is Monica Scott. It would make our day if you became a member of our small town fam by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Small Town Dicks. We love hearing from you. Oh, our groovy theme song was composed by John Forrest. Also, if you'd like to support the making of this podcast, go to smalltowndicks.com/superfam and hit that little join button. There, for a small subscription fee, you'll find exclusive content you can't get anywhere else. The transcripts of this podcast are thanks to SpeechDocs, and they can be found on our website, smalltowndicks.com. Thank you, SpeechDocs, for this wonderful service. Small Town Dicks is an Audio 99 production. Small Town fam, thanks for listening. Nobody is better than you.
Ready to plug into the future of podcasting? The Podcast Show is back. The biggest international festival for the business of podcasting hits London on the 21st and 22nd of May. Join over 10,000 creators, brands, and audio pros for two packed days at the Business Design Center in Islington. We're talking over 130 game-changing sessions with industry heavyweights, award-winning talent, and exclusive parties and networking events that go way beyond the show. And that's not all. The Podcast Show Live brings your favorite podcasts to life at venues across London all week long. Day passes start from just £109. Book now at thepodcastshowlondon.com.